Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks for joining us once again on Queensberry Rules Radio. I am Patrick Connor of QueensberryRules.com, and I'll be joined shortly by James Foley of BadLeftHook.com, just like every week. But I'm going to go ahead and start out, on a little bit of a different foot, I guess. I was going to start out recapping the Adrian Broner card and whatnot this weekend. But, you know, I'm going to go ahead and start out with the flyweights, just in case. But, you know what, I had hyped the flyweights a lot in the last few weeks. Why not? Because it's a great division. I've talked a lot of stuff about how great the division is, how good the matchups have been in the last few years, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't think any of that was a lie. But, you know, I guess we'll start out with Roman Chocolatito Gonzalez versus Akira Yagashi. I'll start here. The positive was that Roman Gonzalez moved up in weight and looked like he hadn't lost much at all. You know, he's a was at junior flyweight for a while and had looked like a monster. He pretty much has looked like a monster his entire career. And he's gone overlooked a little bit, but he still looked quick. He still looks sharp. He's still throwing combinations beautifully, probably better than anybody else in boxing right now. And he defeated the lineal guy at flyweight in Yagashi. And also, Yagashi is tough as nails. He proved that the other night. He stood up to a lot of punishment, took a few straight rounds of getting his ass kicked for him to really fold. You know, and I guess I should just say that referee Michael Griffin, I had to actually think about who it was. I couldn't remember. But referee Michael Griffin, when he had stepped in after Akira Yagashi got knocked down in the ninth round to stop it, he kind of hugged Yagashi. And as he stopped it, the way that he hugged him was almost like it was to say, you know, it's fine. You're good. You're already, you know, you've already showed us all that you need to show. But the thing that was really cool about it to me was that it was kind of like a hug of both like pity and admiration. You know, that's just the kind of pure untouchable shit that boxing deals with, you know, that it really keeps us in it. That just kind of, you know, the really pure emotion that comes after a release like that, after a guy getting a stoppage in a fight that, you know, was taxing, was physically taxing in one way or another. Akira Yagashi just wouldn't really fold. It took a lot of effort to get him there. So, you know, I think that the negative was that most of the copies that I found floating around were not very good. And so that was kind of a bummer, needless to say. I don't know. We're spoiled. We're used to watching in HD and shit. But, you know, a lot of them were just not very good quality. And also I think that there was some question as to whether or not Yagashi was a bit faded, you know, maybe ripe for the picking going in. But, you know, no matter what, Gonzalez did what he needed to do, and it was really solid. Speaking of solid, Foley.
Connor.
How are you, buddy?
I am well. How about yourself?
I'm doing great, dude. You know, we're just, I'm just doing the flyweight shit, man. That's all I'm doing.
All right. Yeah, I'll call back in like 15 minutes.
Yeah, you want to come back when I'm done?
Yeah, sorry, man. We'll cut it a little close today.
Oh, no, dude, no worries. We do have actual lives. I know it's tough to actually believe, but we do. So you had mentioned before the show, just putting it out there, that you didn't see much of the flyweight action, but, dude, no. Listen, though, I was going to qualify that. It actually did take some serious effort, even like, you know, I have some connects, dude, and it took some serious effort for me to track down watchable copies of these. And it didn't happen until a couple days later, really. So I don't really have anything bad to say about you not having seen them, because that was, hey, I don't know. Thanks, Blog Talk, for basically shutting me out there. But that's what happened. Anyway, Mr. Foley.
Hey, I'm back.
Yeah, we both got dropped by Blog Talk for whatever reason, but maybe, you know what, that's exactly what has been happening with the flyweights, dude. They didn't fucking like our flyweight discussion either, those fucks. So, In any event, all I was saying was that it's become really difficult to track down these flyweight fights. Yeah. And now I guess it's becoming difficult to even recap them.
Well, I was frustrated because I have that BN network on my TV, but I guess it was only on, like, the BN Latino network. So I was watching, like, motorcycle racing or some shit, but it was not the Estrada Segura fight.
They're actually, I'd mentioned last week that I didn't even know about that network either until Cliff Rold had pointed it out. And then when I went looking for it, there's like a couple of BN channels on my guide. So I was like, oh, it was actually on my guide. So like, you know, the fight was anyway, so I DVR'd it.
Oh,
and that wasn't a big issue, but the Gonzalez Higashi fight, was like, you know, just tracking down a watchable cop. Finding Jimmy Hoffa's body was horrible.
Yeah, I had no luck on those. I think I saw something floating around on YouTube, but I just didn't get a chance to watch it, and I already heard the result. And I was really more looking forward to watching the Estrada fight, but, again, it wasn't on my cable box, and then couldn't track it down.
Well, here, if you don't mind, I'll go through it somewhat quickly,
right,
I guess. But I'm not going to say this time that you didn't miss much, because it was a watchable fight. It was not a bad fight by any means, although, you know, as you said, BN, the Spanish network, on Saturday. So I kind of had to switch out a little bit just to kind of see what was happening from the Showtime card, that is. But, you know, I would have to say that Estrada is a guy that I've compared to Leo at times. I think it's a pretty solid comparison. You know, he punches hard enough for it to sting, and he'll stop a lot of fighters, like, on accumulation of shots, but he's not going to really, you know, be knocking anyone out cold, but he goes to the body really well. He's going to be a handful for a lot of different fighters. But like Akira Higashi, Giovanni Segura, who Estrada beat down, is in his early 30s and has been through his share of tough action, you know, and early 30s is old for little guys, and Segura sure fought like it. You know, he was tough, and he walked through a lot, but he was swinging wildly. Okay, fun times there. Fucking ridiculous. So if that happens again, by the way, I'm just there's like a new option on Blog Talk for me to connect directly through my computer's microphone, just in case it's my phone, which is, I guess, possible, but never really happened before on the show. But if it is, I'll just call right back, and if it keeps happening, then I'll just fucking end the show and call Blog Talk and tell her fuck off. So anyway, I'm not sure what the last part you heard was, but
You know, you were just saying that both, you know, they're both guys are older, and Segura put up a valiant effort.
Yes,
looks a little wild.
Yeah, and I was saying that outside the ring, Segura doesn't really sound that good. Even some people who don't speak much Spanish, he doesn't sound very good. So, you know, it's kind of tough to rate the win as really huge for Estrada in that regard, because we don't really know how shot Giovanni Segura was. But the answer is, you know, just by looking, probably somewhat shot. So, in any event, Estrada did what he was supposed to do. So that's impressive, you know, in that regard. He went in there and he basically dismantled Giovanni Segura. So the question is, now we're left with a likely Roman Gonzalez versus Estrada rematch happening, which, you know, you didn't really have to see what happened exactly in the fights to speak on that. The point is that, you know, we've been looking at this rematch for a while now because the first fight was damn good. You know, I'm probably going to be singing the praises of the fucking Wealth TV card forever. It happened in December. I believe it was either November or December of 2012. And in any event, you know, it was on Wealth TV. It was a fight card that had five or six fights on it. All of them were either good, really good, or really, really good. Supposedly, the news this morning is that Gonzalez is saying he won't do the rematch for less than $1 million. So, you know, James, we talked about this last week on the show. Chiquita Gonzalez versus Michael Carbajal, too, was the first fight where a fighter under featherweight got paid $1 million purse. That was over 20 years ago. The point is, it's very unlikely to happen. And while I think Gonzalez and Estrada probably, like, deserve a purse like that, and it's justified, it's so unlikely to happen that I kind of have to wonder, like, what Gonzalez's angle is here. What do you think? Is he kind of balking and holding out for more, or?
I don't know, because, like, I don't really have any idea what those guys make, you know, with their TV contracts and, you know, all the revenue from the fights. I mean, I just don't know. You know, I mean, when Gonzalez was fighting in Japan, and, you know, I have no idea, like, what to, you know, based on guys like Andre Berto getting $400,000 to fight Steve Upshur Chambers, then, you know, Gonzalez and Estrada should make $10 million for their rematch. But I don't really know, you know, what they're accustomed to making, or whether that's, you know, it sounds like a pretty, you know, the type of request that would make the fight happening unlikely, because it sounds like a lot more than what, you know, we assume that they've been getting paid. But it's also kind of hard to say that, you know, I mean, it seems like Gonzalez has been willing to fight pretty much everybody in those weight classes. So I wouldn't say that, you know, and he does already have a win over Estrada. So I don't know. I'm not really sure what to make of that.
I mean, there's kind of been, in the last, I would say, 10 to 15 years or so, and I mean, it extends beyond that, but especially so in the last handful of years with teams like Taken in Japan, that a lot of lower weight guys seem to be going over to Japan because there's more of a market over there for them. I don't know if there's just a better appreciation. I don't know if the fans, I don't know. I honestly don't have an answer. For whatever reason, they're better accepted over there. And they seem to make pretty good money over there in Japan. I don't know if it's local TV, et cetera, et cetera. But that seems to be kind of the thinking of Gonzalez. At least my guess is that he's thinking, well, give me $1 million. Give me a reason to fight outside of either Nicaragua or Japan. Because it seems like he's just not really interested in, you know, or at least based on what he's saying about the million dollar thing, it just seems to me like he's not that interested in the rematch unless there's something really big financially for him in there. And I understand that. It's just not really realistic.
Well, what else does he have going? I mean, you know, it's the biggest fight by far, probably beneath,
yeah,
like maybe 120 to 22 pounds, you know, guys like Rigondo and Santa Cruz and Frampton or whatever. But as for the lower weight classes, I mean, that is the fight that's going to get, you know, by far the most interest among boxing fans. So it's tough to say. I mean, you know, maybe he's just trying to make a stand early to try to kind of increase his negotiating power or something like that. But, you know, it's the exact type of fight that needs to happen and should get, you know, absolutely belongs on, you know, real premium U.S. network to kind of, you know, show off the best of that division and to raise interest in those lower weight classes. So obviously it's not a great thing to hear that already there might be some kind of a financial roadblock to that happening.
Yeah, it's kind of disconcerting, you know what I mean? Like, we kind of look at these lower weight classes as like the last, you know, the last hope for a purist boxing fan, where it's like, you know, the fights just kind of get put together because they have to, because there's nowhere else to go. You know, you can't really make a ton of money just, you know, fighting these no-hoper type of dudes when you're that small, because there's no market. But for whatever reason, yeah, it's a bit of a bummer, and I really hope the fight happens, because, as I said, that's probably one of the better fights in boxing right now, and we're looking forward to it. We want to see it. First one was great. Second one would probably be great, too. So, speaking of great,
yeah,
Let's just go ahead and move on to that Showtime card.
I'm glad we got through that segment without me having to crap on the flyweight fetish of so many boxing fans.
I basically was steering it away from that, just in case, because, you know, we've alienated enough fucking people on the show, dude. We alienated Mike Katz. Well, I alienated Mike Katz. You know,
right. He sent us an angry letter.
Yeah, he well, yeah, and it smelled like a neck brace. So I don't want another one. So Adrian Broner, he wound up defeating Emmanuel Taylor this last weekend on Showtime. You know, I spent a lot of time shitting on the card in general. Look, I don't really have a ton to say about the Showtime card that hasn't already been said, but, you know, I'll say it anyway, because apparently I like the sound of my own voice. I'll continue with the negative Nancy stuff, I guess, and say that I've seen a number of media members, writers, et cetera, referring to Broner versus Taylor as, like, an instant classic, an epic, a nonstop action fight. I'm dead serious. I'm 100% serious. I'm not just making this up. And it was in the recap on a number of different major sites, like, you know, just this kind of hyperbole, things like that. And, you know, I'll stop far short of heaping praise on it, but I will agree that it was a solid fight. It was more entertaining than I thought it'd be. And Taylor fought pretty well. But the bulk of the reason why it was a solid fight, in my opinion, was because Adrian Broner, like, isn't that good. We didn't see that much from Taylor that was really complicated or tricky or anything like that. He just let his hands go, and he was able to find Broner, which, again, in my opinion, demonstrates what I've been saying for a while, and that's Adrian Broner's defense isn't all that, no matter how many comparisons to Floyd Mayweather people want to make. Well, mostly him, but it ain't going to happen. So the term accident waiting to happen has also been used a few times. I'd probably be more apt to agree with that. So that, you know, the amount of negative karma he's building up plus the complacency equals he's going to get smashed sooner or later, in my opinion. Pick that up, James. What's up?
Well, you know, in defense of Broner or whatever, I mean, I think that, well, Taylor fought really well. I think Taylor's a solid fighter, and, you know, he definitely seemed to smartly, for once, follow the blueprint of the guy who beat Adrian Broner. You know, and you see that all the time where it's like a guy has taken a loss or whatever, and it looks like he has trouble with a certain style, and then the next fighter fights like the absolute wrong style when you've already kind of seen what works. And, you know, Taylor took a lot of what Maidana did, pushing him against the ropes, throwing, you know, kind of overhand looping punches, and had a lot of moments of success in the fight, you know, and it was a good fight. But, you know, yeah, it's a frustrating card because I didn't find this card anywhere near as objectionable as Danny Garcia, Rod Salka. And the great thing about this card, after the two fights, both guys at least called somebody out, you know, and Matisse made it very clear that he wants that rematch with Danny Garcia, and Adrian Broner didn't mince words. He said he wants the Matisse fight. So I at least respect that, as opposed to a total fucking farce like Garcia Peterson, which no one even cares about that fight, and they fight two tune-up fights, and then afterward they won't even call each other out and say that it's up to their managers, you know. And not to mention, I mean, we parked on for weeks, but the legitimate champion at 140 is fighting a guy barely in the top 50 at lightweight. But that said, I did think Salka totally redeemed himself with his corner work during the whose corner was he in, the Upshur Chambers corner against Berto? I thought he was really good in the corner, actually, and was saying all the things that I thought needed to be said. So Salka totally redeemed himself, and now we can place 100% of the blame for that fiasco on Danny Garcia and Steven Espinoza and Al Haymon. But, you know, with Broner, of course there's some doubts, but I also think that, again, you know, he does have some attributes. I don't think he's a total scrub. I think that, you know, he has some things, you know, I don't see him getting blown out by Lucas Matisse, and I think the fact that a lot of people are looking forward to that fight, maybe some of it is because people don't like Broner and they think Matisse is going to knock him out, you know, and that's a fair viewpoint. But I think a lot of people are anticipating that because it's actually a really good fight. And you know, we regard Matisse as one of the best fighters at 140, and I don't think Broner's that far behind. You know, so a fighter, he has a lot of...
Well, he's only had
Maidana,
one fight at 140.
Right, but I just mean, like, you know, talent-wise, not necessarily, you know, achievement.
Well, I'm sorry, two fights, technically, if you're... Well, yeah, the Carlos Molina. No, he's got... Remember, we talked about it. He's got the regional belt. He's the champion. Sorry,
he's a regional belt holder. Show some respect.
he's the best in Cincinnati.
I think he may be. you know, Broner's still a guy that, I can't completely hate the guy. You know, I mean, I just think that there's something interesting about him. I think he does have some talent, and I think boxing needs you know, heroes and villains. And I think Broner, you know, I think his act was getting really stale, and it was kind of just a lot of, like, you know, stupid jokes and cliches and stuff like that. But recently, I actually think, as much as we gave him a hard time for storming out of the ring after the Maidana fight, I think since that fight, in his kind of public appearances and interviews and things like that, he has kind of tried to refashion himself a little bit and maybe be, you know, somewhat more humble or whatever, or more, you know, not aside from the fact that he tried to choke Emmanuel Taylor 3 days ago, but, you know,
yeah,
it's just Broner. No, go ahead.
I disagree. I don't think that he's changed at all. Like, not
he's
one
the same
bit.
Guy.
I think he's 100% the same dude. I mean,
well, maybe
I
he just
do
has better
that,
writers now. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know what? I think that he probably has been told to tone it down, you know, publicly with, like, the videos and the sex tapes and the Popeye's shit, and the Popeye's shit. But, like, he probably has – literally, there's probably someone, like, some PR person that was like, okay, dude, it's getting attention, but you're starting to creep into the area where people just want to see you killed. So he probably has been, you know, schooled on that a little bit. But I just don't really think that he's improved in the ring from what I've seen. And also, he just seems like – an idiot to me. He still, remember the Beetlejuice outfit that he was wearing the other day with the yellow and the black and white? And yeah, he just seems like a dumbass
yeah.
to me. I don't know. But I will totally, after I've said all of that type of stuff, I will 100% admit that I do have a bias against the guy. It's not like I'm like a super objective dude in this regard. I just don't really like him.
Well, I think that taking the beating from Maidana and not trying to find an easy way out, to me, was, you know, kind of worthy, kind of made a case that there was, you know, maybe more substance to Broner than we had thought. But, you know, you look at the arc of Broner, and I don't really see it like he had this meteoric rise and then just completely fell from grace by getting beaten by Maidana. I mean, Maidana was by far the best opponent that he had faced. And I think going into that, we probably were underrating Maidana a little bit, thinking of him as more of a limited action fighter. You know, when Broner looked so spectacular, he was fighting guys who just had every conceivable disadvantage in the book, and it was a terrible lightweight division, and he was fighting guys who were smaller and, you know, not as fat. I mean, when you have speed and power and size and, you know, and you're getting the push that got him, you know, maybe an arguably a close decision against Ponce de Leon. You're the A side. I mean, he had everything going for him at lightweight, and for the most part, he looked spectacular. Since he jumped up to welterweight, the Malignaggi fight, at the time, I was thinking, like, okay, maybe that was kind of an anomaly and he's just adjusting to the weight. But I think that, you know, I still thought he clearly beat Malignaggi, but I think that that did show that maybe, you know, to anoint him, I mean, what, Ring Magazine had him the number 5 pound for pound, which we all believe
yeah,
was ludicrous. But,
he got
but
hit,
you know.
Like, yeah, exactly. He got hit, you know, like Malignaggi was able to find him pretty easily. But go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
Right, but you got to remember, I mean, you know, yeah, he beat up Antonio DeMarco, who I think also is slightly overrated, and that's no disrespect to him because I really enjoy his fights and I like him as a fighter, but, you know, I don't think DeMarco is really an elite talent, you know, and then fight guys like Gavin Reese, and he beat Malignaggi clearly, but he didn't blow Malignaggi away the way that, you know, the great fighters who have fought Malignaggi have. And, you know, I think looking back, I mean, Maidana, a big, big punching, aggressive welterweight, he's been on a great run in the last couple of years and obviously just gave, you know, Mayweather his toughest fight in years. That was just a huge step up for Broner, and I think looking back, you know, I don't think we can necessarily write him off or say that, you know, he hasn't improved. The thing of it is, like, he hasn't, you know, he's going to have to kind of step up in competition before, you know, he didn't look great against Carlos Molina, but how do you get up for a fight against Carlos Molina? You know, again, Broner was back to the same position he was in at lightweight. He had every conceivable advantage. There was no way he was going to lose that fight. So, you know, you like to see, at the very least, you know, Danny Garcia destroyed Rod Salka and made it clear that he didn't belong in the same ring with him, and Broner didn't do that against, you know, Molina or Emmanuel Taylor. Same time, though, they're probably, you know, a little better fighters than Salka, and Garcia's a better fighter than Broner right now. So I think he's still on the track to where I'm going to have an open mind going into a potential fight if he fights Matisse, if he fights Peterson. And I think that, you know, the guy can still
accomplish some things in the sport. I mean, I'm not going to say, you know, I'm not thinking that he's going to dethrone Mayweather as a pound-for-pound guy, but I do think that he's closer to, you know, the guys at the top of the division like Garcia and Matisse and Lamont Peterson. I think Broner fits in more with them than a guy like, you know, Andre Berto, all due respect, who I think is probably never going to be, you know, sniff the top of a weight class ever again.
No, well, I would have to definitely agree with that. And I think that you do basically take a more balanced approach to it than I do. I admit, again, that I just don't really like him, although I do think that there are good things about him and that he does have potential. He really does. He honestly really does. He has quick hands. He has pretty quick reflexes, although I think he's got the wrong approach when he does when he goes defensive. Basically, I think that if he took if he were more disciplined and he kept his weight under control and he were able to fight more and fight under a slightly different style, like when he was fighting lightweights but they were overmatched and he was whooping the shit out of them, when he kind of came forward and did that like aggressive counterpunching style, I think that that style really works well for him and that there's a good chance he can make it work well at higher levels too. But he doesn't do that style and he starts to try to emulate Floyd. When he gets in any type of trouble or gets hit at all, he just falls back into this kind of shoulder roll type of shell that just doesn't work for him. He can't pull it off the same way. He just doesn't have the same amount of skill is what I'm saying. But regardless, do I think that he's like worthless? No, dude, he's not worthless. And on top of that, he has made for a handful of pretty entertaining fights. So I have to give him credit for that. It's mostly just that I have to question how difficult he's being put in right now and for the type of money that he's making and the attention that he's getting. It seems just kind of misplaced to me, and it seems like a widespread mistaken identity or something like that. But regardless, I understand that they're not going to be letting go of him anytime soon, and I might as well just kind of get used to it. But
that's a case, again, of, like, you know, the alphabet belts kind of creating a false expectation or maybe, you know, a sense of where Broner is, because, you know, really Broner has always been just a contender. I mean, he's never been a true champion. He was definitely one of the, you know, best fighters at lightweight. Moving up to welterweight, you know, I mean, he caught that fluke belt that Paulie had won from Sinchenko. And,
yeah.
You know, where did that belt even come from? I mean, I think it was a vacant that Sinchenko won against marginal competition in Europe. So it's like, you know, Broner becoming that welterweight champ or whatever by getting that belt from Pauly and then getting the Maidana fight. You know, I think it maybe created an idea like, oh, this guy's a three-division champ. You know, he's moving into the pound-for-pound list. He's this great fighter. But you really parse through the resume, and there's just not much there. And those fighters that he beat, even the good fighters he beat at lightweight, you know, again, he just, that Gavin Reese fight was a complete farce. I mean, Reese looked like he was half his size. So Reese is a decent fighter, but, you know, it's just, you have hand speed and every single attribute, physical attribute going your way. It's going to be, you know, those types of wins don't impress me, you know. So, I mean, honestly, the fight that I probably appreciated Broner the most was his loss to Maidana. You know, because in that fight, I mean, beating up DeMarco the way that he did, I guess, was kind of impressive. But, you know, against Maidana, it was the first fight that kind of defied expectations, you know, where he got hurt. He looked like he was on his way out of there in the second round, and he actually kind of dug deep. And I know there was moments where, you know, he looked for some cheap fouls and tried to get help. But, you know, the guy went to the closing bell, took a shitload of punishment, had moments of success late in the later rounds of that fight. And I think that showed us probably the most – that is the most positive sign we've had about, like, what Adrian Broner can potentially become. And, you know, we all know that he's not – he hasn't come across as the most disciplined guy in the gym and stuff like that. So, you know, he's a young guy that I'm still going to look forward to kind of what his next move is. You know, kind of like Sean Porter, you know. I mean, take a loss. Maybe we have to kind of scale back our expectations a little bit. But it doesn't mean that either of those guys can't come back and do some big things and win some big fights in their careers.
James, you got reluctant praise from me for Broner. That's all you're getting.
I want you to put Broner in your top 10 pound for pound.
We'll talk. Well, I'll create a special list for him or something. But Well, if he does wind up taking on Matisse, which is an issue that I think we'll get to in a second, I needed a decent seg to the co-feature, the Matisse versus Roberto Ortiz fight that was in the co-feature on Showtime. I mean, we'll get to the Broner stuff in just a second, but, you know, it's worth talking about what happened in the Ortiz fight, I think. Basically, what had happened was, if you kind of splice a really nice body shot with, you know, what, okay, it was a nasty hook to the body from Matisse on Ortiz and a really bungled count by referee Benji Estevez. So first, James, let me ask you, is Benji Estevez in any way related to Emilio? And secondly, why was Benji, presumably named after the adorable Border Terrier from the movies in the 70s and 80s, racing Ortiz with his count? It was weird. It was like he was in a hurry to get to him and be like, nope, you know, as soon as Ortiz got up. I mean, it was close. Don't get me wrong. I didn't think that it was like a super egregious count, but it was bungled. It was not clear at all. And so, you know, in any event, what do you make of that fight as is?
Well, he spit out his mouthpiece. I mean, you got to charge him another second for that, right?
That's actually a pretty good Bali impersonation.
I mean, I thought it was terrible, so I don't make anything of the fight because I don't really think that the fight even, you know, happened. I mean, I knew, you know, I assumed that Matisse was going to eventually, you know, stop Ortiz in some way or another, and I think that's probably what would have happened, and he obviously was hurt badly by the body shot. But, you know, whatever was going on in his mind, it doesn't really matter. You know, did he want to continue? Was he trying to milk to the last second? And then, you know, whatever. The bottom line is, like, he stood up at 9, so he was up. So I have no idea. I mean, it's just like these guys like are so quick to pull the trigger, and I don't know if Estevez just panicked, but I didn't think he hit 10 before Ortiz stood up. So the fight should not have been stopped, you know. It wasn't some like potentially great fight that you know he deprived us of by doing that necessarily, but I just thought it was terrible.
Yeah,
he
basically just rendered the fight, like, you know, pretty much useless, really. I mean, it was a really nice body shot from Matisse. I'll give him that. You know, it was and on top of that, actually, you know, I rewatched it. Well, it was only like a round and a half anyway, but I rewatched it just because I wanted to see, like, is there anything that I can take from this fight at all? Lucas Matisse was gunning for the body as early as the first round. Like, he was throwing shots, like he really wanted to hurt Ortiz to the body, and he wound up landing one. So, I mean, it's kind of a stretch to be like, I know it was going to happen in the next couple rounds, but it did seem like Matisse was kind of on track for, you know, getting something done sooner rather than later. I'm not going to presume anything, though. Regardless, it was blown. It was pretty much just blown by the referee. So, you know, In which is, you know, a contrast to usually guys blowing the referee. So in any event, it was just kind of a waste. It sucked.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't tell us anything that we didn't already know going in, which is that Matisse is a world-class fighter at junior welterweight. Ortiz, completely unknown prospect from Mexico who had never fought anyone, you know, even resembling a top 25 contender. And Matisse, by all accounts, should have been the better fighter, and he was. So, you know, it's not like as a whole it was some great disappointment, but, you know, it's just that, again, it's just another pretty baffling decision from, you know, one of a boxing authority between the referees and the judges. We get those pretty much every week.
Well, yeah, ain't that the fucking truth? Well, you know, it was just pointed out via Twitter from our buddy Alex Berry, the boxing seed, that he said, remember, the shit was mostly given to Malik Scott for doing the same versus Derek Chisora, which is true. And I don't really think that either of these situations are all that different. I mean, there have been a handful of instances where somebody misunderstood the count, or maybe they were more hurt than they thought or something like that. So I remember the guy, Muhammad Abdullayev, the guy who beat Miguel Cotto in the amateurs, and, you know, they made a big deal about him, and then Cotto wound up beating him. Muhammad Abdullayev wound up fighting, I think it was like Josh Kaladi's cousin, Emmanuel Kaladi,
That shit was on, like, Showbox. Emmanuel Clotty knocked him down, and Abdullayev, like, who doesn't speak English, misunderstands the count in English and, like, hops up at 10 going, oh, shit. You know, things like this kind of happen. There are a whole bunch of different explanations for him. But regardless, yeah, it was shitty. And what probably the shittiest thing about it is that Roberto Ortiz, he's not going to get a rematch. You know, like, if everything was fair, would he get one? Yeah, if everything was fair, he would. But he's not going to get a rematch. So that basically moves us on to the point, you know, Broner Matisse. This is pretty much the whole point. Like, we've been talking about the Garcia Salca stuff, the, you know, and Garcia Salca, Lamont Peterson versus, I can't even remember who it was right this second. And then this card, the Broner Taylor and Matisse Ortiz, this was all just this kind of like lead up to this tournament, basically. But now when we kind of take a step back, you know, based on the writing of a number of people I've read and also just the facts, I don't really see how that tournament could happen. Because there's this whole – all right. And this is where it kind of starts getting more complicated than it really, like, needs to be here. But, okay. I don't really understand how – the Haim guys are split from the Golden Boy people, and now Golden Boy is talking about working with Top Rank, et cetera, et cetera. Then there's talk that potentially Danny Garcia could be in line to face Manny Pacquiao, and this is where I think it starts kind of getting a little convoluted.
Is that real,
but interesting.
Though? I mean, who knows?
Well, it is kind of a speculative thing, but there's also speculation that these two cards in question were basically just time wasters until – you know, more stuff is sorted out between Haim and Golden Boy, Showtime, and all
that speculation. That's not speculation.
Well, so,
the point is,
maybe they didn't just go ahead with the whole quote-unquote tournament thing because they couldn't, because it's not possible. If that winds up being the case and none of those fights happen or even just one of them happens, it just means that we wasted two Showtime cards just there, 100% waste of time. And I mean, yeah, okay, you know, we are already kind of on the same page here. This is not that surprising, but at the same time, just outright realizing it, holy fuck! I don't even really know what to say to that.
You feel shock and betrayal?
I'm like Jodie Foster in the Accused, dude. This is bad.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. It doesn't seem like there's any reason why Broner and Matisse shouldn't or couldn't happen. Danny Garcia, who knows, because, you know, just his opponent selection has kind of been a little troubling, and it does kind of have that feeling like they're saving him for a mega fight or something. But who knows, man? I mean, it's just getting more and more annoying to talk about. Like, Peter Quillen, you know, turned down $1.4 million. Huge payday to fight Khorovov, which is not like some huge mega fight that everyone's been clamoring for, and Khorovov is a fringe top 10 contender, and whereas Quillen is seen as one of the top middleweights and has one of the belts, or had one of the belts, you know, and that can't happen. So, I mean, it's like, what are they waiting? What is everyone waiting for? I mean, who knows? You know, it's just impossible to, it doesn't look good. And I'm just saying it's annoying to talk about because it's kind of like, I don't get the sense that it's going to really get any better, you know? So we're basically just going to be coming here every week to shit on whatever, like, mismatched card that Showtime and Haim put on until this gets, something gets resolved, I guess. But, you know, what is Quillen waiting? What fight does Quillen have that's bigger than that in terms of a payday? What fight does Danny Garcia have? I mean, maybe a Mayweather fight somewhere. Maybe like you said, if a Pacquiao fight, if that could be worked out. I understand where Garcia's coming from. I mean, he won the big fight against Matisse. He became the legitimate champ. He has some potentially big fights on the table. He's undefeated and young in his prime and all that. But you know, guys like Broner Matisse, I mean, that should definitely happen. I mean, there's no reason why that shouldn't happen. You know, so hopefully, or, you know, even Broner fighting a guy like Lamont Peterson, I think would be treated, received pretty well. Because, and that's the whole thing, is like, no one cares about a Peterson-Garcia fight, because we've kind of already seen, you know, Peterson falter against the best at 140, against Tim Bradley, against Matisse, got blown out, you know. Broner's a contender, kind of trying to get his, you know, get into the top, you know, the top of that picture. So for him, a Peterson fight makes perfect sense because Peterson is, you know, a very credible, you know, top five guy who basically only loses to those real elite fighters. So, I mean, that's, but so any one of those fights could happen. But Danny Garcia, who the hell knows? Because who would have predicted that he would be fighting Rod Salka? You know?
Well, just to kind of, like, answer your question on, like, why wouldn't they be able to make that matchup? Well, one of the whole contentions, which I believe was, well, it wasn't like, the point wasn't invented by Scott Crist, but he really made a point to, you know, single it out and, you know, highlight it, that Adrian Broner is one of the few fighters who was both with Al Haymon and Golden Boy, because the whole thing about this split, and I mean, I don't want to get too much into it and take up too much time with this shit, but the whole point was that supposedly Richard Schaefer was getting people on board with Al Haymon, but not actually having them, you know, binding by contract to Golden Boy, so that they were being represented by Golden Boy without actually being, you know, represented by Golden Boy. So that's kind of the heart of, you know, the split or whatever. And that's what the concern is, as far as whether or not they might be able to make that fight, because Lucas Matisse isn't on the same boat. He's represented by Haymon, but I think has some type of loose connection to Golden Boy. So that's where I think they're worried that, like, the split or whatever is going to get worse before it gets better. And anyway, my point is more just like, if we're just sitting here acknowledging that these two cards were like a total waste because they were supposed to lead to something, and that's why they were made in the first place, and then, you know, aren't made. Just what a fucking utter frustration, dude. Yeah, that's all.
Well, I'm becoming really frustrated myself with just in general how bad that it's become. You know, the whole landscape with boxing these days, and how impossible it is for the, you know, the guys that we love watching, how hard it is to see that for them to get into big fights, and they treat things like, you know, like Amir Khan, Josecito Lopez. That's a really good fight, but this year, that, I mean, that looks like this like incredible, you know, like you know, the awesome matchup that. We should all be loving, as our boy, like, Sled Skills said on Twitter. So it's just, like, the thing, I think, increasingly, my opinion of Al Haymon, I think he's great for the individual fighters, at least in the short term, but he's definitely, it's been terrible for the fans. And, you know, if the networks didn't enable it, it wouldn't be happening. You know, if they weren't, I mean, the Andre Berto can get a $400,000 purse to fight, you know, Upshur Chambers is just, I mean, that tells you almost everything that's wrong with boxing. If we had $400,000, imagine the type of card we could put on, action fights between, like, you know, lesser known, you know, even journeyman type, you know, that it would be much more watchable than this. And you give that to one guy who's not even a viable contender in any division, who's been, you know, just had the crap kicked out of him three times, the last time against Soto Karas, who we love, but who clearly is you know, a level or two beneath an elite fighter, and he's getting $400,000 in a comeback fight against an underdog anywhere from 20-1 to 100-1, you know. So, I don't see, if you're Al, you know, I want to go give Al Haymon an award as manager of the year for getting a fighter $400,000 in that situation. The people we should really be blaming, like I said before, is Showtime Sports, because they should see, they would appear to be an independent, you know, party in all this, and to make those kind of decisions and spend money like that. And what people don't understand is they can argue all day about, like, oh, the alphabet belts are great for the fighters, and Haymon, you know, it's a business, and we're doing this, you know, for the fight, you know, like, when fighters are making a lot of money and not taking that much risk. But when you start taking that risk out of it, that's the reason they get paid so much money, you know. And without that risk, eventually it turns off the fans. And I know a lot of people are already fed up, and we've been getting frustrated.
Well,
and when the fans go away, there is no more money.
I'll tell you this much, dude. for all of the talk about, you know, Adrian Broner's popularity and all this type of shit, you know, and I'm not gonna totally disagree. I'm not saying he's not a popular dude, but for the marketing about him being the next superstar and having some type of following, and the fight was in Cincinnati, which, you know, it was nice that he drew whatever it was, 7,500, 8,000 people, but, you know, we're talking about, you know, that should happen one time in Omaha a couple months ago and people were tripping out. But regardless, the ratings are what really move people to make decisions, and the ratings weren't very good. It topped out at like 800,000 and something, and the average was like 700,000, which, you know, when we're talking numbers from this year even, that's not very good. So, yeah, there might be already a little bit of a backlash in the way of numbers.
Well, I think over time it's inevitable that if boxing continues on this path and these are the type of fights are more common than, you know, competitive fights that fans look forward to, you know, eventually, I mean, the ratings will get so bad that the premium networks will stop covering them. And, you know, the promoters, managers, they're going to have to try to put on independent pay-per-views or sell them to another network that's not going to pay anywhere near as much money as what HBO and Showtime have. And, you know, at that point in time, who knows what the future of the sport will be. But it's like with everything else that's wrong in boxing, a lot of which is just the very nature of the sport, you know, the fact that the people who, the powers that be can't give us anything better than this, it's just, you know.
Yeah, it's pretty weak. It's pretty weak. You know, I'm all for, you know, staying busy and all that type of shit, but, you know, let's call it what it is and let's stop spending money the way we are then, and let's take this opportunity, the slow season, let's take this opportunity to give the fighters a lesson on what they're actually fucking worth and not, you know, inflating their ego to the point where we're getting worse fights than we even would in the first place because of that. Anyway, you know, Andre Berto picked up a win, so yeah, I had at least one reason to stroke my dick this weekend, so that was nice.
I like Berto, and, you know, I mean, I just don't see him really being competitive against top guys in the division, which that's not really a problem in itself, you know. But I mean, it's just you know, it sucks that a guy like Rigondo can't get on TV. And you have guys like Austin Trout who lose a couple fights and he's back on ESPN2 Friday Night Fights, yet Berto gets just annihilated by fighters much, you know, lesser than Canelo Alvarez and Arislandi Lara, the guys who beat Trout. And yet, but Berto comes back for a $400,000 payday on Showtime. I mean, I don't know. I just don't understand the way the business works, I guess. But
yeah,
you got to say that. Say what you will about Al Haymon, but he takes care of his guys.
Yeah, to the detriment
to the
of the sport,
the
but he does.
yeah.
But he does,
of the
yeah.
Sport, for sure.
Well, I mean, I just, you know, for a couple months there, I'm sure you remember. I mean, we both do a lot of illicit drugs, so we probably don't remember. But for a couple months there, I kept asking on like every single show. I was like, "Is Al Haymon good for boxing, James? Is Al Haymon good for boxing?" And that was the thing. It was like, well, you know, we don't know if he's good for boxing yet, but he's good for his fighters. And I think that it's starting to become clear that, you know, as his stable grows, as his influence grows, he's not good for boxing. Not all the time, anyway. And maybe perhaps the majority of the time he's not good for boxing. You know, looking out for fighters, getting them paid, you know, this is good. But it's like laundering their money for them or something. It's like rather than getting someone a job, like a legitimate job somewhere, you're getting them like an illegal job or something. You know what I mean? Like you're taking care of them, but there's a really big elephant in the room here.
Well, the problem with even talking about this is, like, because it's so murky, we don't even know how the Haymon network operates or who makes the decisions or who's responsible for the fights being made.
Who does he
anything.
Go through? Yeah,
so
who does he go through? Nobody knows.
It's just convenient. Yeah, but, you know, you could say, like, oh, man, fuck Al Haymon. He sucks. I can't believe this shit. Meanwhile, it's like Golden Boy Promotions on Showtime. But they have no responsibility in this? Who's Al Haymon? He's not around. His name's not on this stuff. He's just a manager getting his fighters huge paydays. So why is he allowed to have this type of power that we all assume that he's just behind the scenes pulling all the strings and making all these shitty fights that no one wants to see? I mean, I don't know. But who's enabling this to happen, you know? You've got to point the finger at the network that is paying for these things. I mean, it's absurd, man.
Yeah, I just don't really get it, really. I mean, I would have liked answers, and pretty much like that whole main events lawsuit, I was really hoping we were going to get something out of that, because I figured we would at least get kind of a peek into exactly how Heyman runs business. I remember when a handful of years ago when Lennox Lewis sued Don King and wound up winning, there was this big story, and I think it was Sports Illustrated, because when it happened, Don King was forced to open up the books, which he hadn't done in however many years. And so, you know, I remember there was this big story titled something along the lines of Rare Glimpse into Don King's Pocketbook, as, you know, as he's in court or something like that. And I just remember it was a big thing, because we found out that he's not really worth quite as much as we thought he did. You know, he was playing with a lot of borrowed money, et cetera, et cetera. So it kind of, I was looking forward to that. But of course, now that, you know, Bernard Hopkins and Sergey Kovalev are fighting, there's really no reason for the lawsuit. And it got dropped, which sucks, because I wanted to know. I still want to know. It's my right.
Well, I think that, you know, interesting thing that'll happen is if Golden Boy does branch off and completely disassociates itself with those fighters, takes what it has left, which I'm not sure exactly who that is, but guys like Canelo Alvarez and Abner Mares, and, you know, starts working with HBO again, I think you'll see some better fights getting made potentially with, you know, those guys and some top-ranked guys. I think that'll be interesting to find out what happens to all these guys, you know, like Danny Garcia or, you know, a lot of fighters, and a lot of them around that same weight class from 140 to 154. But really the only fight that with two Heyman guys that I can remember recently that seemed to, you know, was really a good fight and got a lot of interest is was the Danny Garcia-Matisse fight. And if you remember at the time, Matisse signed with Heyman like pretty shortly before that fight happened. And it almost seemed like it was just an inevitable clash. Like they had to fight and Heyman just kind of wanted to have both sides of it, you know, to kind of hedge himself in case Matisse won. And Matisse was also getting a ton of buzz at that point in time. It was probably a little bit hotter commodity than he is now.
Yeah.
Just because he was just destroying guys. And I think the Danny Garcia fight kind of put a halt to that momentum, obviously.
Yeah,
so, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens going forward.
Well, I just, you know, I hope that my only point with that whole thing was just that there seemed to kind of be like, all right, well, you know, we're sitting through these crappy cards, but there's kind of a light at the end of the tunnel. At least we're going to get, you know, some type of pittance out of this. Well, more than a pittance, really. I thought the tournament was a pretty good idea, but it was just now looking at it and then looking at the, you know, Lamont Peterson thing and, you know, our really, 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 really good buddy Rick Glaser pointed out that Lamont Peterson's been saying that he's taking on his mandatory, and so is Danny Garcia. And so that fight's not going to get made, and now they're like, well, if that fight's not going to get made, then what the fuck is the point of Broner fight, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, and I believe our buddy Glaser, dude. He's not going to lie to us.
The last thing on Heyman that kind of raised some eyebrows for me was that I noticed that he recently, in the last couple few months, and he's signing a lot of guys who appear to be more opponent-level type fighters.
Yes.
And
yeah.
I hate that I can't think of anyone else because I love this dude on Twitter and I think he's hilarious, but like Caleb Truax signed with Al Heyman. Now, Truax is not somebody that anyone's predicting is going to become a real player at, you know, super middleweight. He's a, you know, good, tough, hard-nosed fighter, but he's not really somebody that you can see becoming, you know, a major in terms of popularity, in terms of skill, in terms of anything, really. So
yeah,
when,
nice dude.
When I saw that,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's a hilarious dude. If people got to know his personality, maybe he could become more popular, sure. But, you know, but he's not. But that kind of signing makes you think, like, okay, that looks like Heyman's just lining up an opponent for something, you know, like Anthony Durrell or one of his fighters in that weight class. And there's other stuff
like
that going on. Which makes you think, like, you know, is that the kind of matchups we're gonna be getting?
Well, actually, if you kind of look at it, dude, I mean,
this whole thing with the whole split was kind of looked directly at Richard Schaefer. And when Richard Schaefer was with Golden Boy, that was one of his kind of MOs. You know, he signed fucking Vivian Harris a couple of years ago to Golden Boy, and people were like, Viv Harris? That motherfucker was like, you know, out a couple of years ago. And people were like, why the fuck is he getting signed to Golden Boy? Next thing you know, he's in as an opponent for, I don't even remember who it was, but he got put in as an opponent for somebody, and I was like, oh, okay. And so then that's what they started doing is signing these guys that were, like, basically meant to be opponents. And I was like, damn, that's actually a pretty damn good idea. Because at least from that guy's perspective, they're like, oh, you know, not only is their kind of morale has been raised because they just got signed by a big promotional agency, but two, now they're kind of like, oh, well, they all not only did that, now they're getting me a big fight. Nice. Like, this is an opportunity. You know, none of these – I would have to say very few of these guys are going into fights going, you know, I'm going to lose. So in any event, it's a pretty good strategy, and I'm glad you brought it up, actually, because I had totally not even thought about that. And like you said, Caleb Truax, nice dude, funny dude on Twitter especially, but, yeah, just not a super high-quality type of fighter. You know, he's the type of guy you'd like to see get better opportunities because of his personality, just quality-wise, not really up there, or at least not you wouldn't think. So, yeah, he probably is being taken on more or less as an opponent, unfortunately. Before we get on to this weekend stuff, I'm guessing you did not see Frampton Martinez too.
Oh, actually, I did watch that.
Did you? James, you fucking fox. I love it.
Yeah, thank you.
So,
thank you.
Oh, man. Eesh, dang, I think it moved. I think I got a little bit of a boner. So, I mean, I don't know if you saw the first fight, but I guess I wrote a spiel.
Yeah,
I didn't know if you'd seen it. And so, you know, Frampton pretty much proved to be too quick, too shifty, too clever for Kiko Martinez. Second fight last weekend. I was in Belfast for the second time. And, you know, Frampton's getting fairly popular in Belfast, as I understand it. I was looking at pictures this morning, going through news, et cetera, and there was, you know, just crowds of people basically celebrating his win over Kiko Martinez. I think the picture was from yesterday. And, you know, the first time it was, even though he wound up beating Kiko Martinez by TKO, I thought it was a little bit more of a struggle for Carl Frampton. He got hit a little bit more. There were moments when Martinez was able to really push a little bit more effectively, et cetera, et cetera. It actually wound up being a pretty entertaining fight. This one was a little bit more one-sided, I thought, and that he wound up using his legs basically perfectly. So, yeah, it basically seems now that edge of, you know, the Frampton-Martinez saga is done. And it looks now like they're really pushing for a Carl Frampton versus Scott Quigg matchup. And Scott Quigg has been getting some pretty, I don't know, pretty nasty press this week from what I've been hearing. It sounds like there have been a lot of kind of anti-Scott Quigg commentary in regards to that, because it's a bit of a local rivalry that's brewing, it seems. I don't know. What did you think of the fight, and what do you think of the possibility of a Quigg matchup?
I thought, you know, Frampton was really, really impressive, and especially since Martinez has been on such a tear lately and looked so good in his last few fights, racked up some big wins on the road, you know. And,
definitely.
So I mean, I love the Quigg fight. You know, it's be a huge domestic fight. I loved how after, on Saturday, after the fight, Frampton called him right out, you know, didn't none of this stuff with, you know, it's business, I got to check with my manager, none of that shit, just, you know, called out Quigg and called him out hard. And that's the kind of thing that really does get, you know, fans galvanized to kind of make a fight bigger, try to make it happen. So, I mean, I think that's great. And, you know, again, I was just really impressed with Frampton's boxing and the way that he moved around the ring, and especially, you know, his combination punching, and to have, you know, gone out that hard in the last couple rounds with what looked like a pretty big lead already and really try to close the show. I thought was great.
Yeah, and it was. I actually thought it was a relatively entertaining fight too. I the way I characterized it earlier was like, you know, it wasn't entertaining. It was an entertaining fight. And actually, I was a bit surprised by that, too, because from the outset, it seemed like Frampton was I didn't see it live, of course, because I usually work Saturdays, but I wound up watching it later. And from the outset, it seemed kind of like Frampton was just going to be outdoing him all night, which he kind of did. But Martinez is a scrappy dude, as evidenced by that fucking nail in the coffin punch, what they called it when Carlos Mousa did it to Vivian Harris. Basically, Carl Frampton had slipped from a punch and was kind of face down, and Kiko Martinez comes over him and just, like, batters the back of his head with a punch.
Oh, I totally forgot about that, yeah.
It didn't land super hard. It wasn't kind of like the type of thing where, you know, it was more like it seemed like people were laughing and going, that ballsy fuck, when he did it, rather than going like, ah, take his head, you know. So it was kind of funny. Bullshit, but funny. But regardless, Frampton wound up putting him down pretty hard. I think it was the same round, like about a minute later. So, yeah, he got revenge for that, and it was a good win. It was a good win for Frampton, and I think that he really kind of pushed himself into the consciousness of a couple of U.S. fans over here, which is good, too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's definitely going to be a player, I think, at 122, and somebody that, I mean, the Quigg fight's huge. I would favor Frampton, and if he moves past that, then I think he should be right in the mix. Heard some talk about Santa Cruz, and Abner Mares called him out during the fight. Not really called him out, but, like, mentioned that he'd be interested in going to 22, going back to 122 and fighting Frampton. So, you know, just sign me up for all of that. I mean, I think that's awesome if that's the path that he goes on.
And our dude, Mickey Landsman, that I've name-dropped a handful of times in the last few weeks because he's been a loyal listener following along. We appreciate that again, Mickey. But he pointed out that UK fans seem lucky and that they have regional rivalries and the type of thing that can draw 16,000 fans. And, you know, that seriously bears repeating, really, because we just don't really have that type of thing here often in the U.S., despite the fact that we have so many more people here. And you would think that we would just be able to, I don't know, just figure something out and make a fight popular enough that can draw that many people, but isn't a Floyd Mayweather fight or isn't a Manny Pacquiao fight or something. But, I do kind of envy that in a way. Go ahead, sorry.
And, well, just, you know, look at, like, European soccer rivalries compared to, you know, a lot of the, like, our domestic sports. I mean, it's just not quite the same. I mean, we have a few really, you know, huge rivalries in different sports here, but I think in general that it's just sports fans are much more passionate, I guess, and vocal and tend to turn up. But a big part of it, too, I think, is, like, from what I've seen, you know, they really cover boxing like a major sport in England.
Yeah.
Whereas
yes, no,
here
they
don't.
Yeah, and it really is. Well, I mean, there's a real, it's just a different culture of boxing, really. And, I mean, there's just a really rich development of talent on a local level. And, you know, I mean, people go apeshit for Golden Gloves and amateur matchups over there where they're packing in, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 people in for these amateur tournaments. It's like, you know, I wish, you know, a big part, I don't want the gloominess and the crazy the crazy pasty people with bad teeth. No, I'm kidding. But no, I'm not kidding at all. Yeah, I'm not even remotely joking. But really, I do envy that a lot. And shout out to my boy Jordan Singleton, who I don't know if he was at the fight. I haven't gone and checked, but I know that he's had a good time reveling in the craziness that has come in the fight's wake. And by the way, just a quick side note, he and I have been doing those kind of video documentaries, and we're going to have something pretty fun for everybody at the end of the month. So that shit should be pretty cool.
Oh,
we're going to
awesome.
Make it a series. Anyway, this Frampton business. So it seems like if Scott Quigg is able to take care of business this weekend against Jamoye, I think it is. Shit, let me look. Yeah, Stefan Jamoye. It seems like an alphabet unification. Junior featherweight is up on the table there, and so it also seems like there's enough trash talk too, like you said, to sustain a bit of a rivalry that should be pretty significant on that side of the pond. So I'm looking forward to that. I think that's pretty good stuff there, and I'm happy that you saw that shit because I really wanted to talk about it, bro. It's hurting. So now, you know, the moment. Well, no, that was the first one. No, that was the first one. But the the moment everybody's been waiting for that's listening in live, all fucking 14 of you, no, not even 14. But Floyd Mayweather versus Marcos Maidana, too, coming up this weekend from Las Vegas once again, of course. How much are you looking forward to this fight, James?
Well, because we've been so deprived of anything resembling, a major fight, I guess I am kind of looking forward to it, to be honest. Nothing on the undercard, but which I'm not even sure what's on the undercard, so you can maybe enlighten me in a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
But
we'll go over that. I will shit all over it in a couple minutes.
I know some of the names on it, but I don't know any of the matchups, I guess. But I'm looking forward to it, man, to be honest with you, because I love Maidana, and I think as long as Floyd is still kind of regarded as the best fighter in the sport and clearly the biggest economic draw, his fights are always going to be big events, although I do think this is going to have really disappointing pay-per-view numbers, if I had to predict that. I don't think there's any buzz mainstream for this fight at all. Most of the people that I mentioned it to didn't even realize that this was a rematch. So, that said, it's always, with Mayweather and among boxing circles, it's always going to be a big fight. And I just love Maidana as a fighter, as a person. And I actually kind of am going against the common logic that says that Mayweather will have figured him out and improved and, dominate him in this fight. I thought Mayweather clearly won the first fight. I thought that he clearly won maybe 6 of the last 7 rounds, something like that. But I never really felt like it was domination, and I actually don't expect that Mayweather's going to improve on that performance. I think I still have to. Well, I favor Mayweather to win.
I don't mean like interesting as in like, James, you're an idiot. I mean like interesting as like, I was wondering who was going to be coming out and picking Maidana, or at the very least, nudging him some respect based on the first fight. You know what I mean?
I wouldn't pick Maidana just because I think, picking the upset against Mayweather is basically just kind of a trendy move to say that, there's like no real risk to it. And I don't think there's any evidence that suggests that Maidana will beat him. I mean, unless Mayweather was in like a real 50-50 kind of fight, and I think Mayweather still rightfully is a pretty big favorite here. I don't think it makes sense to pick against Mayweather just on some kind of blind hope that he gets old overnight. So, I still favor Mayweather to win the fight, but I think it's going to be very similar to the first fight in terms of somewhere around an 8-4 kind of fight and very entertaining, and Maidana will press the action, and I think Mayweather's going to take a few rounds to kind of get into a rhythm just like he did last time. And I think it's going to be kind of similar to what we saw the first time, with potential for maybe Maidana to improve, I actually think. And I know it's crazy, but I just think that, styles make fights, like they always say. And I think at this point in Floyd's career, without the legs to move around like he has in the past, I think that he's forced to kind of stand and fight more. And against a guy like Maidana, who throws so many punches and comes forward, it's going to take like a lot for Floyd to kind of, get into the fight, and just like it did the first time. I think it'll happen. I think you have to give Mayweather the benefit of the doubt that it will happen, and he'll figure out a way, and he'll win, and he'll bank the rounds that he needs to. But my kind of gut going in is that it's similar to the first fight, with maybe the potential for Maidana to do better, meaning that I think Maidana was maybe 2 or 3 clear rounds away from most people thinking that he won that first fight. So I don't think he was that, it was that far away. I certainly thought Mayweather won it, and I understand why the rematch doesn't have a lot of buzz to it. But I personally, I think it's going to be a lot like the first fight, which I thought was really entertaining and had a lot of compelling moments. So I'm looking forward to it.
Well, we've all seen the first fight at least once, though us purists have seen it on at least 3 continents. And that's neither here nor there. It sure looked, though, like in typical Mayweather fashion anyway, Floyd had begun to figure out Maidana's aggression about, maybe about halfway through. And that and the fact that Maidana quickly ran out of steam in a number of rounds kind of meant Floyd took a deserved, convincing decision on my card anyway. But that's how I scored it, like, in Antarctica. But, you know, whatever. This time, I'm not really sure there's a whole lot Maidana can prove on his on his performance. But, I mean, you know, there's some little things, though. Like, I think that if he adjusts his right hand just a little bit, that he can land on Floyd's chin rather than his chest, or at the very least his temple or something like that. You know, some more feinting, stuff like that. You know, but there's also his stamina. But beyond that, he really pushed, he tried, and he came up a little bit short. So in my opinion, a lot of this hinges on Floyd's legs, which I've said before. So, you know, Floyd has lived a pretty clean lifestyle. He stays in shape. He stays in the gym pretty much year-round, even when he was retired. So that kind of lowers the probability, I would have to say, of him getting, like, hit in the temple and, like, losing his legs out of nowhere, or just, you know, getting old out of nowhere. You know, it's kind of playing a waiting game
but
Floyd Mayweather.
You know,
but there is a potential there, because the longer it goes, the more likely that is.
Well, that's the thing. Is like, I don't think he's really getting old overnight, which I know a lot of people have kind of been waiting for that. You know, I think there has been a gradual slowdown, and there is some physical wear and tear, and you see that, and the fights have become tougher, and he's stood his ground more and fought more, you know. And I think that, I don't know, I just think that the notion that Floyd is, you know, utterly invincible and he will always kind of, you know, he's 37 years old. I mean, that's the big thing here. You know, he's clearly moving out of his physical prime. And I think that created a lot of opportunities for Maidana in the first fight. And I just think that Maidana is more likely to fight, you know, the same type of fight that he fought in the first fight than Floyd kind of just all of a sudden, you know, being able to, you know, Pernell Whitaker circle around the ring for 12 rounds and just pick Maidana apart from the outside, because he doesn't really fight like that. He's going to kind of be there. It, you know, his reflexes are still great. I think he'll still be able to defend himself and eventually kind of warm up and be able to kind of find the target with his own punches. And he's obviously always been a really accurate puncher. But I just think it's going to be pretty similar. And I think there's always that possibility. You know, a lot of Mayweather fights recently, you know, the thing with Maidana, he's a powerful puncher. He can punch. So we know that not only will he be aggressive and throwing a lot of punches and maybe winning some rounds as he did in the, you know, first half of the first fight, I think the guy has legitimate power to hurt Floyd. I just don't think he ever really landed clean, especially not upstairs in the first fight. But, I mean, I think that it's possible that that could change. So I don't know. The more and more, I mean, maybe I'm just talking myself into it, you know, because you know, the schedule has sucked so much recently, and I just want something to be excited about. And obviously it's not exciting if Mayweather just comes out and dominates him in kind of a listless, you know, 108 performance. But I just think that Maidana has shown a lot in the last few fights. I mean, I don't know what the hell happened against Devin Alexander, but ever since then, I mean, he's just been a you know, come forward, like, just like he had before, all action, and he's managed to be competitive and, you know, win some fights he wasn't supposed to, and you know, his whole career, I mean, there aren't many guys that he's fought who have come out completely unscathed. I mean, really, Devin Alexander was the only guy to really score, you know, that type of a dominant decision against him, and I think he's become a better fighter, and you have to give Robert Garcia some credit.
Well,
even though I don't really care
for
the guy that much, but
I was just going to say, like, you know, in regards to the Alexander fight, and, you know, I don't want to, like, make excuses for Maidana. Well, no, I do want to make excuses for Maidana, because I like him and would like to bear his children one day. But not to make too many excuses for him, but, you know, Devin Alexander kind of had to drag that fight down in order to do what he did a little bit. And also, I think that, if I'm not mistaken, it was Maidana's first fight with Garcia, wasn't it? Anyway, it's not really that important, but
I think it was before he was with Garcia.
Maybe that was why he switched to Garcia. I don't remember, but regardless, yeah. Even to kind of play devil's advocate, like, against myself a little bit, and kind of piggyback off of you know, like, what you were saying a little bit, I've seen, and you will probably see, a bunch of comparisons from Floyd Mayweather to Bernard Hopkins in the sense that, like, you know, they're both getting older. I mean, they're obviously separated by a couple of years there, but just in the sense that they're getting older and they're not really seeming to degrade that much. But I think that, well, number one, you don't really see that Floyd Mayweather has taken that type of style change. Bernard Hopkins used to be like a grinding type of guy, you know, kind of like a boxer slash grinder. He can do it from the outside, but he was more effective really, like, you know, getting inside and like grinding a dude down. As he started to get older and as, you know, his reflexes and all that type of stuff started to go, he changed from that into a guy who would basically try to pot shot from the outside and then do everything he could to stifle the fight inside, which is not what Floyd Mayweather is. He's had to stand his ground a little bit more, and he's probably taken a little bit more damage, you know, willfully or not, than Bernard Hopkins that did, you know, when they both kind of came to that turning point. So I do think that there is, you know, there is a possibility there that Maidana is going to be able to find something. You know, he wasn't really that far off in the first fight. And I, like I said earlier, I did think that Floyd Mayweather won, not handily, but clearly. And regardless, it wasn't like it was, you know, 10 rounds to 2 or something like that. Most people seem to have it around 7-5-ish. That's not that far off from, you know, a draw or even Maidana win.
Yeah. I honestly, I think I had it like 8-4, 9-3, but I felt like I gave Floyd the close a couple close rounds. So, I mean, I could see those scorecards.
No,
I did think that,
that's what I did,
know,
too,
Floyd,
yeah.
I did think Floyd clearly won the fight. I guess a lot of it depended on how you scored those first 6 rounds. I mean, I saw some guys who had Maidana up 5-1 and then kind of found a couple close rounds in the, you know, second half that they gave Maidana and had him winning 7-5. But that was certainly the minority opinion, which is why, you know, in a sense, I mean, this is a fight that probably didn't really need a rematch. But I think looking at Maidana, I do think he's arguably, you know, not the most compelling opponent, but not the worst opponent either, regardless of the fact that they've already fought once. And you know, there's always a possibility. I mean, of course, we see Mayweather as a cerebral boxer who's going to make adjustments and kind of figure out. But I think a big part of that, like I said in a previous show, I think a lot of it's just physical. I mean, you can't really, you know, yeah, I guess there's some nutrition, and he's, you know, maybe Alex Ariza has some magic stuff that can, you know, resuscitate Floyd's legs. But I do think a big part of the first fight was that it just took Mayweather a few rounds to get into, you know, kind of get into a physical rhythm with his body when he's being attacked by a guy throwing 100 punches around coming out of the gate. You know, and I don't see how that would change in the second fight. I think he's going to have kind of that same issue. But
yeah.
It's also like, yeah, so I mean, I think that what I was going to say is, like, of course we consider Floyd the boxer and the thinker, and, you know, because he's been so brilliant, and he always has just a great game plan and a great, you know, he's great at taking away his opponent's offense and all that stuff. But everyone's kind of discounting any possibility that Maidana may make some adjustments, like you said. And the thing of it is, like, he wasn't far off from really having a case to have won that first fight. So it's not completely out of his reach, and I just don't see that we're going to get, like, you know, a much better version of Mayweather. I think it's going to be the same Mayweather. He was still great in that first fight. He still had some great moments, and I thought was, you know, did very well to come back and really take over the fight. So it's not like, you know, the same Mayweather is a scrub that Maidana's going to just blow through. I'm not saying that, but I do think that, like, again, it's going to be kind of a close fight like it was the first time, and we'll see what happens, you know.
Do, 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 this just in. I mean, totally calls Mayweather a scrub.
No, the big question for me is, if it does unfold in the same way, what happens in the second half of the fight? You know, can Maidana, because he did seem to gas at points, and it was probably a combination of his own fatigue and throwing so many punches, as well as the fact that Mayweather was hitting him so clean, which, you know, discourages all of Floyd's opponents. I think that's going to be another question. You know, will it unfold the same way? Maidana comes out fast, Floyd adjusts, Maidana kind of loses some steam. Is that going to happen, or does Maidana have another gear he can find this time, or can he, you know, land a kind of a fight-changing knockout punch? But I think there's enough intrigue going into it. I mean, with Mayweather, he's always going to be, you know, the presumptive winner in basically any fight. I mean, including against Pacquiao. You know, my heart might go with Manny, but everyone would be picking Mayweather to win that fight now. So, you know, Mayweather's always going to be a favorite unless he goes up and fights like Golovkin or somebody like that. So,
yeah.
But I think with that said, I think this fight has as many kind of, you know, kind of wrinkles to it and possibilities that maybe something, you know, something more interesting could happen. Because certainly we didn't expect the first fight was going to be competitive at all. And most people thought Floyd would dominate Maidana because, you know, Maidana at times appears to be kind of a limited, you know, kind of flat-footed brawler type. So the first fight was kind of a pleasant surprise. And I think that, you know, again, I think that Maidana brings some things to the fight that will make it interesting. And that's all I really am rooting for, and it's what I expect. You know, I think a 37-year-old fighter who fights with Floyd's style is going to have some difficulty with kind of a strong guy who comes forward and just throws a lot of punches.
Well, at the risk of opening the Ray Rice fucking Pandora's box here, do you think that... I kind of have to sum it up. I'm sorry, but I think it was either yesterday or the day before. What's her name? Miss Jackson. I can't even remember her real name. Miss Jackson, the lady that Floyd Mayweather was, you know, whatever, buying stuff for a while, is suing Floyd Mayweather for, I think she said something along the lines of attempted kidnapping and. Anyway, basically just kind of doing what Floyd Mayweather has done to a number of different women, apparently. So is this going to affect Floyd's game at all, do you think?
Doubt it. You know, I mean, who did he fight right before? I mean, he was facing a 3-month jail sentence. Was that the Cotto fight that he went into right before that? And that obviously didn't affect him at all. So, I mean, I think when he gets in the ring, no, I don't think it's going to be a distraction at all. I mean, I think that Mayweather, of all things, you know, if there's anything to admire about him, it's the fact that he is incredibly disciplined and he shows up in peak condition every single time. And he's never had an off night. I mean, the closest thing he's had to an off night was the first fight against Maidana. And that was, you know, I think largely the result of his age and the style. I don't think it was an off night. And eventually he showed a lot of the same brilliance, you know. And seeing Floyd being forced to open up, it's made him look better. Because, you know, in recent years, I mean, I just think back to, I guess, that Shane Mosley fight when he got kind of, like, wobbled in the second round. And then he's put on just an utter clinic for the last 10 rounds, you know. And in many ways, it was just a spectacular performance, but it was excruciating to watch. And it wasn't exciting in the least bit, and a lot of that was because Mosley just basically stopped throwing. But some of it was because that's just Floyd's style. He's so methodical. So when you have these fighters, like I thought Cotto did a great job pressuring him in a few of those rounds, and Maidana, it brings out the best in Mayweather, and it just in the ring it makes him look better, you know.
Yeah,
and I think that's good to see because he has an incredible arsenal of skills. And it's frustrating to watch when he can kind of just toy with a guy and pot shot him like the way that he did with Mosley or Canelo or, you know. Guerrero, I think he opened up a little bit more. But in general, you know, it's like these types of aggressive fighters bring out, force Floyd to be more offensive. And, I mean, that is enjoyable to
or
see
less
just
offensive.
From the perspective. Right. Yeah. To our sensibilities, for sure. Well, here's another interesting question, Patrick. I'll put you on the hot seat.
Do it.
Because you brought up the Ray Rice video and all that.
Yeah.
So there's been some talk, I guess, kind of, you know, why don't we harp on the fact that Mayweather's had a history of domestic violence incidents, pretty well documented and very disturbing. And, you know, we don't know exactly what Miss Jackson's case is, but you don't have to use the term allegedly because Mayweather at least, you know, pled guilty one time and got a conviction. And I think he has two convictions related to some type of domestic violence charge. So there's no allegedly about it. We know for a fact, at least legally, that he was guilty of some of these things. Now, is that something that needs to be brought up, I guess, in the lead up to all of his fights? That's kind of been like a side issue between amongst some of our lowly blogger friends and myself.
Hey, I mean, look, all of
yeah, it's like slaughtered with that one.
I know, it's tough. It's tough, but all Twitter and internet machismo aside, I think that probably the world at large, but especially American society, is still pretty male oriented, and I think that it's still difficult for women to really find any type of equality. And I mean, I'm really trying to keep it specific and not get too broad and philosophical here, but I think that that is probably the baseline problem here. However, if we're comparing the two things, and basically the question is, why is Ray Rice getting dropped from the Baltimore Ravens, and why is Floyd Mayweather basically getting away with over 10 years of abusing women? And that's not an exaggeration. This is just, look, dude, when you're fucking accused of something for, like, it's like Cat Williams said about fucking Michael Jackson, you know, when you're accused about some shit for a fucking decade, you know, it's kind of tough to really overlook that shit. So point is, you know, why is Ray Rice getting punished but not Floyd Mayweather? I think that there's a couple different reasons, and I'll try to my best to be brief. I think that a big part of it is that the money that Floyd Mayweather brings to the state of Nevada and the sport of boxing is a lot more pinpointed and specific, because the sport of boxing is about individuals and not teams. And I think that Ray Rice could get dropped from the Ravens, even though he's a really good player and he's an instrumental part of the Baltimore Ravens. He could still get dropped from them, but be replaced and have somebody in his place that does okay. You know what I mean? So it would be seen as less of a blow to the team, much less the sport, than Floyd Mayweather getting locked up for beating women would be. And I think that that's a really big part of it, money, connections, et cetera. But also I think that, and this is really fucked up, especially with this Ray Rice thing, and like there's debate over like why now, why only now, because we saw the video. I mean, it fucking sucks to say, but it is reality. The video is far more visceral than hearing the facts that happened. I mean, we all knew that shit. I knew that shit. I don't even follow, you know, a whole lot of like sports and news at large. You know, I follow like world news, not really like local tabloid shit, but I knew about what happened. And, you know, when I heard about it, it was like, you know, people were making jokes after Beyonce's sister attacked Jay-Z because they were just like, ha, 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 you know, now fucking, what's her name, Solange is pulling fucking Ray Rice, blah, 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 and it's like elevator shit, blah, blah, blah. And it was funny, but then the video comes out and people are like, oh, damn. Well, because he straight up knocked her out cold. We already knew that. We already knew that shit. So I think that if there probably was some video of Floyd Mayweather doing it, it probably would be a lot more visceral for some people and be like, holy shit, what are we looking at here? So I think that, you know, there's a lot of different factors. It's complicated, blah, blah, blah. It's just, I think that those are probably big reasons here.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is no justice in the world because it really shouldn't have mattered. I mean, we saw a video of Ray Rice dragging her unconscious body out of the elevator 2 months ago. We knew that he knocked her out.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it didn't change anything that happened yesterday, but, you know, the real inside the elevator video was released. But, you know, and who knows? I mean, yeah, we should just move on, I guess. But it is kind of, you could throw out a lot of interesting hypotheticals. Like, what if it had been Peyton Manning? Would he have been released by his team? You know, a real superstar franchise player like that? Because Ray Rice was seen by a lot of people as kind of past his better days anyway. Or, you know, if Mayweather, if there was a video, would there be, I mean, what kind of pressure could even be applied? Like, the only people that would really have the power. I mean, somewhere would license him. You know, that's just the facts of it is, because money talks, I guess, more than whatever else. But I just thought the interesting thing was kind of, you know, the two opposing views seem to be Mayweather had, you know, all of these incidents have been in the news. I mean, we wouldn't be talking about it if we didn't know about them. So it's not like there's been some real cover-up to, you know, stop us from knowing. I mean, we know about all the allegations against Floyd, and we know about his actual criminal cases where he has, you know, been convicted of it. So that's all out there, and he did, you know, he's paid his dues to the justice system, at least, although I think some things you can never really completely be absolved of, and I think he should always carry that stigma with him. But, you know, I think the point of it is that, you know, he paid his dues, and he's a professional fighter, and if you write about the sport of boxing, you're covering the fighters, you know, and is it, or the alternate, you know, the other view being that, like, what he did was so evil and insidious that it requires, you know, mentioning in every single piece that you may ever write about Floyd Mayweather. And I just thought that was kind of an interesting debate of, you know, should we be kind of like, you know, mentioning this and leading all of Floyd Mayweather's fights, or has man, you know, paid his time and we all know he's an asshole, but we don't need to, you know, harp on it constantly. And I mean, personally, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that I'm with you. I think there needs to be some context here. You know, I mean, I think that there, for example, Alex McClintock, who we've had on the show before, wrote about it earlier today on Queensbury Rules, and he mentions that Kevin Ioli's piece doesn't mention the, I guess, the history of abuse with Floyd Mayweather until a couple paragraphs in. And, you know, and I do think that it's important to kind of keep track of that, and also to hold people who are in the media and who are in the, like, kind of the face of the media not accountable. I mean, it's not like Kevin Ioli did anything. It's just that I think that we should expect them to mention these types of things that are prominent and important. But at the same time, there's no context for it. If I'm writing an article about Floyd Mayweather and there's really no context or no reason to bring up the like allegations or his history, then I'm not gonna. You know, I don't. There's no obligation for me to. However, at the same time. I mean, do I think that this is the type of thing where he's like a child molester? You know what I'm saying? Like, this is not like, what's his name? Davey Hilton, I believe it was, right? Where,
no, I mean, I do. I think it's just
like,
bad,
this is not
know,
that
to be
type
honest,
of thing.
To be honest with you. I think it's, I think it's just as bad. I mean,
don't get me wrong. I'm not downplaying at all. I'm not at all downplaying it. I'm just saying that I don't think that it's quite on that level. However,
he's not a serial killer either, but you know.
No. And like I said, like, there are varying degrees here. However, at the same time, like, do I think that he's a piece of shit for it? Yeah, of course. Like, I mean, I'm not going to, like, run around making excuses for the dude, you know, hitting women, of course. So it's just, you know, if we're looking at this in the context of, like, just fighting or whatever – I don't really have a problem with somebody not bringing it up, is what I'm saying. But is it important? Does it open up a larger debate? You know, yes, it definitely does. And it's unfortunate that he's largely getting away with it in a number of ways. And on top of that, really prospering financially despite it. So,
I
feel kind of conflicted, like a lot of people do.
Some people have, yeah, but, you know. I guess we'll never really be able to, you know, we can't solve all the world's problems on TQBR radio, but just one other comment that, like, I always seems like a really nice guy, but yeah, that article that he wrote about Miss Jackson's lawsuit, I mean, it was written by someone who needed access to the Mayweather camp.
Yes, it was somebody, like, apologizing
you know, I mean,
as they're writing for it, you know, yeah. I know, I'm with you.
And I think, yeah, I mean, I guess I don't really need it to be constantly invoked every time we discuss Floyd Mayweather. I mean, I don't mind people, you know, mentioning it because I think it has, you know, kind of been swept under the rug, at least as far as in a lot of the promotional things and stuff like that. But you know, the information's out there, and anybody can easily, you know, Google Floyd Mayweather and read all about all of his criminal issues and read about basically how much of a scumbag that the guy appears to be.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish there were a more measured debate about it and that people could be more objective. But I don't know. I don't know. When money gets pulled in like that, you know, people stop giving a shit, unfortunately. Well, you know, I guess let's move on from shitting on Floyd Mayweather and let's go on to shitting on the fucking undercard of this fucking Floyd Mayweather fucking fight. Fuck. On the highlight. Okay, let's put it this way. When the highlight of your pay-per-view undercard is Miguel Vasquez versus Mickey Bay, it's not really a good undercard. And no, we don't always buy or watch these types of cards for the undercard. But
pretty much the utter dismissal of boxing fans this year when it comes to this type of thing, undercards and whatnot. It's been kind of shameful. You know, that said, I'm one of the few people who often doesn't even mind Miguel Vasquez, you know. I know that I had this debate with you know, our buddy who was on the show not long ago, Adam Abramowitz, from Saturday Night Boxing. But, you know, I don't really mind him a lot of the time. I can even enjoy him some of the time, but I'm realistic about what he is to most people, and that is, you know, not entertaining in the slightest, and I respect that. But he's kind of hit a stride in the last 4 or 5 years. Lightweight just is not a quality division right now. I mean, what is this fight, James?
Well, it's curious as to what Mickey Bay has done to, you know, earn a title shot against Miguel Vasquez when, you know, the guy who knocked Mickey Bay out, John Molina, is also on the undercard, not getting a title opportunity.
Yeah.
Although I don't know, maybe the Molina fight was at 140, and then I think it was at lightweight. Maybe Molina's fighting at 140 now or something. I don't know. I mean, I think Mickey Bay is like reasonably talented for kind of a prospect. I think Vasquez is,
he's not a shitty,
you know. No, he's decent. This is a totally undeserved opportunity, but
that's what it's come to. He's not shitty anyway. I mean, you know.
He's a nice guy.
I'd have a beer with him.
But, yeah, putting Vasquez on a pay-per-view doesn't seem like really a recipe for, you know, action. And then Bay's more of a boxer himself. So, who knows?
Yeah.
Kind of an interesting, like, you know, chess match-type fight, but nothing that, you know, I wouldn't really even be excited if it was, like, the opening of a triple header on Showtime.
It's just not, yeah, it's not really pitting guys with super fun styles. You know what I mean? Like, that's what it comes down to. And also, I have to say, kind of like last week when I was talking about, you know, the fight kind of suffers from negativity surrounding Mickey Bay. You know, one being associated with the money team, which, like I said, you know, Jay Leon Love last week was a bit of a pariah for it. And then two, because he tested positive for, if I'm not mistaken, it was elevated levels of testosterone by, like, quite a bit, which, you know, even that has been a specific hot-button issue, you know, even beyond the overall, you know, baseline PED and sports issue being hot-button as is, you know? So,
well, Victor Conti is going to clean that up.
Oh, no, I know. I'm just waiting for him to.
Yeah,
I'm just giving him his opportunity.
There will be no more PEDs in boxing.
I'm just kind of like stepping aside. Like, I was at the forefront, bro. I was on the fucking front lines in the trenches battling with PEDs, okay, like up in San Francisco. And then next thing you know, like this dude with the leather jacket swoops in, moves in with Victor Conti, and I'm out. So I'm just letting Victor Conti do his thing.
Hey, were you, like, about 10 years ago, I happened to be a bike messenger for Balco Labs?
I'm a non-disclosure agreement, Ken. No. Can't say anything about that. So, yeah, I can't do it. I mean, inside the ring, this is not a super, you know, entertaining matchup. It's just not. It's two guys that are, you know, like to move a lot, try to counter with quick shots. We could be looking at a fight with, like, a lot of twitching and fainting and shit. Not a lot happening. But, you know, the pressure is going to mostly fall on Mickey Bay to do something. And I kind of feel like it's unlikely he will, although, you know, I totally forgot about this until I looked at Miguel Vasquez's record on BoxRec. I totally – dude, he forgot – or I'm sorry, he fought Canelo Alvarez twice.
Yeah.
Once at 140 pounds and 147.
Well, yeah, that's the great –
I totally forgot.
Bradley was – that was his other – that was really
yeah,
his three losses.
Bradley. I was like, whoa, holy shit, I totally forgot about that.
He's got a better like resume than any of Al Heyman's fighters.
I know, it's like a bit of a mind blower. I was like, what? I don't know. Point is,
and went the distance with Alvarez, right?
Yeah, it went the distance with him twice, at 140, then 147. Like, he went up for him. He was like, all right, let's go. I'll fight you now again, 7 pounds higher. But you know, I gotta respect that. It's just like we said, not super entertaining, unfortunately. But that's the highlight. Leo Santa Cruz is also fighting on there. He is fighting, who is it? Gosh, what's his name? Roman.
It's Rod Salka's younger brother.
Todd Salka. Yeah. Todd Salka. I don't even know if I wrote down the name of the dude that he's fighting. But I looked it up. It's something.
Manuel Roman.
There you go, dude. Manuel Roman, yeah. Anyway, point is, he's fighting, and, you know, I don't know. I could be wrong here. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Leo seems to be kind of suffering a little bit of, like, backlash among the fans, and I'm not really totally sure why. I mean, he still gets in the ring, still throws a lot of punches, goes to the body like a madman, you know, gives a serious effort. And
because his level of opposition has decreased in, like, every single one of his last five fights.
Well, you know what? I think that he kind of, like, I don't know. Well, no, I do know why. He kind of followed up Abner Mattes trying to get that fight, but Mattes was already chasing Nonito Donaire. Both of them have lost since, and now he doesn't really have anybody. So I kind of, in a slight way, feel bad for him because, I mean, it's not like he did anything wrong necessarily. He still gets in there and, you know, pushes the pace, you know, is in pretty entertaining fights. But, yeah, at this point, it's just kind of like, well, shouldn't we be seeing better by now? I know he's still young. He's still, I think, like 23 or 24, but, yeah, kind of should
That's
be seeing
point.
Better by now.
Oh, he's 26.
Well, whatever. 26, 24, I don't know. Point is, still young, but he's kind of at the point now where, I mean, a lot of the guys that he's faced in the last, you know, I'd say 2 or 3 years, Eric Morrell, Alexander Munoz, Christian Mijares, those guys are like 33, 34, 35, and, you know, they're not big guys, so they're kind of, you know, on the other side there. I don't know. I guess that's an upside is Manuel Roman. He's like 23, so I don't know. I'm trying to be positive here.
Positive. That's what it's come to, is like selling opponents by their ages.
Well,
you know, he's in his 20s. He's a healthy guy.
You know, he's a Scorpio. He's pretty good. He can get in there. Yeah, it's a bummer to see, like, you know, a guy like Leo Santa Cruz, who seems to have a lot of promise, and, you know, for a while there was getting a fair amount of press anyway, at least within boxing. Seemed a lot of people seemed to be excited about him. I was excited about him. So,
yeah,
bummer to not see him being pushed a little bit harder, I guess.
Well, maybe, again, it's not really fair because, you know, on one hand, I mean, the alphabet belts are laughable and, you know, we should ignore them as much as we can. But on the other, it does, you know, just like with Broner, it creates, like, an impression of a fighter. And, you know, Cruz has been a so-called, you know, champion, although not really, but been a titleist for, you know, 6 or 7 fights now. And that does create this idea that, you know, come on, this guy's got a belt. He's at 122. He's a top-rated guy. Like, why aren't we seeing him fight, you know, Rigondeaux? Why aren't we seeing him fight the best fighters in the division? Where on the other hand, you know, in reality, you know, the real world where the alphabet belts are should be meaningless, you know, he's just a contender who's come up, moved up in weight, beaten some fighters who were, you know, well past their better days, some quality names like Mijares and Eric Morrell, but, you know, the guys who just weren't really going to pose a challenge for a variety of reasons, mostly, you know, they were, you know, too much punishment in their careers, and they slowed down a bit, and they're older and smaller, and, you know, Cruz had every advantage. So, yeah, we'd like to see these guys in fights where they're not, you know, 6-1 favorites against a guy who, you know, their last great win was in 2007. You know, we'd like to see, and there are opponents for him, you know, and Mahrez is a guy that you mentioned who should be back, although who knows what he's doing, but, you know,
yeah, I don't
probably
know
should
what
be fighting, you know, sometime. But, you know, you have some good featherweights. You have good guys at 122. And Cruz, until Cruz is in a fight with someone of that quality, where it's actually something close to a 50-50 fight, we're all going to start losing interest.
Well, and not to drag us back into that whole, you know, Cold War bullshit, but I had totally forgot about this, but Leo Santa Cruz is actually an Al Haymon guy. So that means that he also probably has, like, a minimum guarantee or something like that for, you know, when he fights. So that also could be a little bit limiting as far as the opposition, in addition to the whole Cold War thing. But But still, you know, yeah, there are some guys there to for him to fight. And also, you know, the kind of the upside of trying to fight a guy like Nonito or Abner Mares after a loss is that perhaps you might be able to get them at a better price. You know what I mean? So,
right.
Yeah, I wish he was getting pushed a little bit harder. But at the same time, at the very least, he's still a fun dude to watch. You know, I'll still watch him. He's still my boy.
Yeah.
Just saying.
But, you know, it's just if fighters are going to fight these kind of fights, you prefer it to be like situations like Golovkin or Kovalev where
no question.
They obviously want to fight bigger fights. They just can't get those fights. You know, Cruz is a guy who seemingly
no
can kind of call his own shots. In fact, I would say that Santa Cruz's popularity has probably even exceeded his actual accomplishments. So, you know, the fact that he's even in a position where guys like Frampton and Rigondeaux want to fight him, I think is telling, you know?
Yeah, perhaps, yeah. Well, and it also shows that, I mean, the pull of Showtime, Heyman, et cetera, that, you know, he even with potentially inflated popularity, he's still really not that popular, but it's popular enough that these other guys are like, I want a piece of that.
Yeah, he's got a fan-friendly style, and, you know, he's gotten a lot of TV exposure. And remember, he was the first guy on CBS when they had that one show on when boxing was going to make its big return to network television a couple years ago.
Had a couple of those
work
in the
out.
Last few years.
Yeah,
we've had that a couple times. But, yeah, you're right, yeah. Yeah, it's a bummer. Yeah, but I'm hoping we'll see that ironed out.
Yeah, I want to see. I mean, Frampton is the perfect guy, or Frampton and Quigg, a winner of that fight. You know, someone who's also young
exactly.
in their prime and a full-bodied, you know, super bantamweight, not a guy who, you know, was a you know, had an alphabet belt at like super flyweight, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, let's see what else is on. Oh, that's right. Speaking of, you brought it up earlier, John Molina. He's also fighting on the undercard, and he's fighting Humberto Zorita Soto. Should be, I don't know. I don't really know. But I'm not really looking forward to that at all,
you know,
actually.
What to expect there, you know?
I mean, you know. All right, so this is Molina's first fight since the loss to Matisse in April. And, I mean, that's a leading contender for fight of the year, so I'm not going to down-talk that fight at all. You know, Molina's been in a number of entertaining fights, you know, but I think what made the scrap with Matisse so good was how surprising it was that Matisse struggled like that with Molina. You know, Molina's kind of proven himself like somewhat limited in the past. You know, he can punch. He has a good jab when he uses it, but he froze up against DeMarco. He had to bail himself out against Mickey Vey and Hank Lundy. You know, he lost to what's that guy's name? Andre Klimov, you know, because basically he just didn't throw.
Yes,
that was him just not throwing. Like, he didn't, like, lose. He just refused to throw for, like, minutes at a time. And, you know, I don't want to be just, like, negative, but these matchups, they have names, but they're not good matchups. Humberto Soto hasn't been in a serious – he hasn't had a serious win since maybe Urbano Antillon a few years ago in, like, 2009 or something. It was a good fight, but – even then, Antillon was kind of seen as like on the downslide because people had seen him really fading in the gym and shit. And he got a lot of mileage out of that win over Rocky Juarez in whatever that was, like 2006 or something when Rocky was beaten. Not a bad fighter, but we're like 8, 9, 10 years on now. So these just aren't good matchups. They're not. I don't think anybody's going to be able to talk me into that they're good.
You know, man, this is the one that I think is probably like the best matchup. But, of course, comes with, like, massive disclaimers that, you know, Soto may be shop-worn. Molina just may not be that good, but probably coming off the most impressive fight of his career to even be able to, you know, drop a guy a couple times and be as competitive as he was with Matisse, I think boosted Molina's stock. And, you know, Soto is a good fighter, but it has been a few years. I mean, that fight with Antillon was a great fight. I think that was one of the best fights of that year. And, you know, he fought Matisse, too, and it was a pretty brutal demolition, although Soto, you know, went down swinging. He's a fun fighter. I mean, I guess there's questions how much he's had left. I noticed he's had a bunch of wins in a row against guys who probably just aren't that good. I guess you kind of have to favor Molina just based on what they've done recently, but I think this might have potential to be a fun fight. I guess I just, you know, Molina does seem like he would be the a bigger guy and a bigger puncher, but I think Soto.
I think Molina's activity in boxing, maybe.
I don't know.
Molina is just going to be the fresher dude, like period.
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
I
mean,
see Soto getting totally blown out of the ring, but I could also see Soto actually showing some life and being competitive. And I think this has a better chance. You know, it's not as interesting or whatever as a fight as like Vicky Bay and Miguel Vasquez, but I think if Soto has anything left, it'll be a much more exciting fight, a much more watchable fight.
Yeah, that's true. It could be more aesthetically pleasing over Leo Santa Cruz's fight. Yeah, it could prove to be a more aesthetically pleasing fight for sure. I mean, just based on the styles involved there. And Humberto Soto has been in a handful of good fights, but, you know, even recently, just not against very good opposition. And that's what kind of, you know, has me hesitant about. Well, I mean, just the card from top to bottom. Well, not top to bottom, sorry. The undercard from top to bottom is just not good. I mean, you know, they're also throwing in, you know, Alfredo Angulo in there, who's,
yep.
I mean, dude, I have legitimate concern about that dude. You know, we have like 10 minutes left or whatever, but, and I don't want to get into too many little side discussions here, but, you know, he's coming off the loss to Canelo Alvarez, and he's been beaten up in three of his last five fights, like, significantly. You know,
but
again,
pretty
like top-notch
against
really
good competition, you know. And,
yes, but he's taken serious ass kickings though, like
yeah,
sustained
yeah.
ass kickings.
Well, the Kirkland ass kicking looked like a career ender, and then the Arislandi
yeah.
Lara looked like his eye just exploded, you know. And then Canelo just tees off on him for 8 or 9 rounds.
Yeah, I mean, all three of those were like career ender
yeah.
beatings, you know. And so I'm just kind of like, I'm worried, you know, and there's a chance, there's totally a chance that he could have more than I think. And I hope he does, because like I said, he's likable. He has a good story. You know, he has a good style because he's not super quick, but he just comes forward, he throws. And I like that, but I don't want to see the dude, you know, just like mumbling in a year.
Well, yeah, I don't want to see that either. Definitely seems like a nice guy. But, you know, I think the opponent that he's fighting is a pretty healthy underdog.
Don't worry about that happening this fight.
James De La Rosa
is who he's fighting. And so if you know, even just kind of take a gander at the record, it's probably safe to say that Angulo is being put in there soft enough that he should get the win, but, you know, difficult enough that he might get a couple rounds, you know? So it's probably a relatively safe fight, but, you know, it's just the long-term concern, I think, is totally legitimate, not cliche.
Well, he's kind of like Berto, you know, like I don't see either guy being able to compete at the top of the division. And I think it's troubling that both guys may end up now becoming kind of stepping stones for somebody, you know, just casting the last of their name in a fight where they're almost, you know, certainly going to, you know, take another beating. And that's kind of what I've seen. You know, we saw Berto, it happened 3 times. We saw, I mean, Angulo recently, like you said, you know, Canelo-Lara fight and Kirkland fight before he had that long hiatus. It seems like when these guys step up to fight that level of fighter, that's what's going to happen. You know, and there's really no point for that. And then to see them kind of, it's just typical kind of boxing business at its worst.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, you know, like we've always said, you know, the guy's got the right to make a living and continue fighting
yeah.
as long as he can medically licensed to do it and all that. But he's not going to somebody that I think I'll ever be excited about a fight again. You know, I mean,
against the right opponent, maybe, you know, against like
yeah,
just
maybe,
really the
maybe,
right opponent,
maybe. But, you
yeah.
know, those are the type of fights that let's say you match them up with another kind of fun fighter on the same level that where it looks like it could be a really exciting fight. Well, what does that mean? You know, exciting fight means like brawl, means that
yeah,
it will take another you know, brutal,
right
brutal punishment. And I just don't really want to see that regardless.
Yeah, actual
you know?
Career ender, yeah. you know, that I guess gives us a good opportunity to end the show on a, you know, somewhat introspective philosophical note that we do every so often, that, you know, it's kind of, this is just, again, one of those things that makes it odd and great and bad to be a boxing fan all at the same time, where, you know, we're kind of this constant struggle of, we're, you know, trying to understand why we like seeing these motherfuckers get hurt so bad, but then at the same time going, well, we don't want them hurt that badly, just a little bit. Just enough to fucking give us a boner. You know, we don't want them to die. We just want them to come really close to death. We're sick bastards. We're sick bastards, James. And we have a show about being sick bastards.
Yeah. Well, you know, we want them to, it is fucked up, and it does tap into a lot of things that most people probably wouldn't want to really talk about or acknowledge. Although, you know, most boxing fans are just such barbarians, they probably would proudly display their bloodlust, you know, and everything like that. But I think it's, you know, we like seeing in boxing, you see people overcome adversity that you don't see in it like any other sport. It's not like, yo, totally, their team was down by 20 points and they came back and won. You know, it's like, no, this guy was like a couple punches away from being dead, and he came back, got his wits about him, and somehow won the fight and knocked the other guy out. You know, like that kind of shit. And you just, yeah, and that's like, I guess it's like there's definitely like a sense of kind of like voyeurism and wish fulfillment in the sport, where you're watching these you know, human beings doing like seemingly superhuman things in terms of recovery, power, and everything else. And so, you know, that's why everyone loves Gotti. But was Gotti's career good for Gotti's health? Probably not.
No.
No, and I think that, you know, not to open that whole can of worms, but it's pretty likely that, you know, guys like Gotti, guys like Edwin Valero, a lot of the tragedies that they, you know, inflicted, well, Valero, different cases, but, you know, guys who kind of meet these tragic ends either at their own hands or whatever, I think a lot of it, you probably could tie it to, you know, the path that they chose and taking the, you know, taking punches to the head, and it's obviously not good for you. And you look at all the suicides of former NFL players. So, you know, the things that we go crazy about and get excited about have real consequences for the men who are doing them. And it's kind of like the side of boxing that we don't really want to think about too hard, or else we probably would never watch the sport again.
It's tough because it makes us think. It makes us start questioning why we like this and what we're doing sometimes. And, you know, it's a hell of a lot more enjoyable if you don't do that. But, you know, that's exactly why day in and day out we're grumps, we're haters, we're not real fans, you know, stuff like that. And it's just, okay, I don't really care if people say that about me. It just is what it is. You know, if me being a complicated boxing fan who is able to see things from a multiple different angles is bad or gay or whatever, then I guess I'm fucking gay. You know, it just is what it is. I prefer looking at these things from a bunch of different angles. Anyway, that said, we got about a minute left. Very, very enjoyable show once again, Mr. Foley. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, man.
Always a pleasure. So,
you're
everybody,
still at the top of my pound for pound blogger list.
Oh, yes, dude. I was hoping I wouldn't lose that fucking spot today. You know, Ray Rice and all. So, everybody, thank you for tuning in. We definitely appreciate it. Definitely. I'm going to look at some numbers after this and see what we got. If any less than like 50 people tuned in, I'm going to bitch. Check out James Foley's stuff at badlefthook.com. He's a hoot. Check out my stuff at queensberryrules.com. We'll be covering the fights all weekend, and we'll see you next week. Take it easy, everybody. Bye.